The full name of the Gita is Srimad Bhagavad Gita. Just as there can be no cloth without threads, there can be no Hinduism without the Gita. So close and so intimate, almost inseparable, is their mutual relationship. And yet, not many are aware of what the Gita contains. The Gita is a part and parcel of the Mahabharata, Bhishma Parva, chapters 25 to 42, the great epic, also known as the Panchama Veda or the fifth Veda. It is in the form of a dialogue between Arjuna, the great Pandava hero, and Sri Krishna, considered as God incarnate. The total number of verses is 700. What are the factors that have made the Gita so famous? They can be listed as follows. Firstly, the person who taught it was Sri Krishna, revered for over 5 millennia as an incarnation of God Himself. Secondly, the recipient of the teaching, Arjuna, was not only a great hero, but also a close devotee of Sri Krishna. Thirdly, it was taught not in the serenity of a forest hermitage, but in the din and bustle of a battlefield, where the issue involved was either victory for dharma, righteousness, or martyrdom in its cause. Fourthly, the answers given by the Lord Sri Krishna were and are relevant for all time. They are eternal truths. That is why the Gita has been specially declared as Upanishad, Brahmavidya, and Yoga Shastra. It is called Upanishad since it contains the esoteric teachings of spiritual wisdom. It has been designated as Brahmavidya since it teaches about Brahman or God. It has been named Yoga Shastra because it deals with yoga or sadhana, spiritual practice. Due to these very reasons, the Gita has been widely translated into several languages of the world. The Gita begins with the background of the battlefield of Kurukshetra in a dramatic setting. Arjuna, who had arrived on the battlefield full of the valorous spirit that befitted a warrior, lapsed into languor, almost bordering on cowardice because of the sight of Bhishma, Drona, and others in the field, with whom he had to fight and kill them if need be. His conscience did not consent to kill these venerable ones, that too for the sake of a paltry kingdom. So, he regretfully decided to retire from the battlefield and to live by begging. Sri Krishna tried to rouse him from this mood of dejection into dynamic action by his clarion call. This is nothing but a demeaning distress of the heart, O Arjuna. It is fit only for the imbeciles and not cultured heroes like you. When even these strong words of admonition were not effective, Sri Krishna had to take recourse to a long disquisition on the philosophy of action and duty in order to destroy his deep-rooted delusion. Arjuna's arguments boil down to this: killing others is a sin. It is an even greater sin to kill the respected ones like Bhishma, as also brothers and other relatives, and that too for the sake of a kingdom. It is far better instead to desist from it and to live by begging even. Sri Krishna's reply is direct and crystal clear. Here, the basic question is not whether to kill or not to kill. It is one of punishing or not punishing the ones guilty of heinous crimes committed out of crass selfishness. Which punishment is necessary to protect the world from their depredations? When all methods of peaceful negotiations like sama, good words, and dana, spirit of give and take, fail, and the wrongdoer or the enemy is obdurate, leaving no further room for the settlement of the disputes, it is the sacred duty of a kshatriya, especially of the royal race, to subdue or even destroy these enemies of dharma and hence of the society and re-establish the rule of law and order. In this effort, the kshatriya should either succeed or lay down his life in the effort. There is no other alternative. This is a great responsibility that the society has put on his shoulders. Hence, he has no other choice but to discharge it as best as he can. In case he tries to escape from it, awful ignominy will surely overtake him. According to Sri Krishna, death is preferable to such ignominy, especially for a great hero like Arjuna. Dealing with the question of killing or being killed in the battle, Sri Krishna declares that all the living beings, being souls immortal, will never die since they were never born. The soul has neither birth nor change nor death. It is eternal and immortal. All these changes pertain only to the body and never to the Atman, the soul, who dwells temporarily in it. Hence, a wise person, understanding this eternal truth, should perform his duties with an unwavering mind. Sri Krishna further says that even if one accepts the view that one is born with the birth of the body and dies with its death, there is no use grieving over it, since it is unavoidable. Once a person is born in this world, he has to engage himself in some work or the other. Everyone has to perform his allotted duties, however unpleasant it may be. Sri Krishna calls this as that person's swadharma, one's own duty. The main reason for our experiencing joy or sorrow in the performance of our work is our attachment to it. We are happy if the results are pleasant and unhappy if otherwise. What is really needed is that we should abjure our desire for the fruits, as also the tendency to work with selfish motives, and to cultivate the habit of performing our work as a bounden duty, as a service to mankind and for pleasing God. By this, we not only obtain all the results in full, but also great peace of mind. This concept of Nishkama Karma or Karma Yoga is a unique contribution of Sri Krishna to Indian spiritual wisdom. Associated closely with this is another contribution of Sri Krishna, that of expansion of the concept of yajna or sacrifice. During those days, performance of yajnas was an important aspect of religion in practice. Hence, he accepts it as was prevalent during those days, but expands its scope to include a few more things that are useful in the evolution of the individual and the society. According to him, Yajna is not just an oblation of certain materials into a duly consecrated fire. It is the offering of everything that an individual has and willingly gives for social good, thereby discharging his debt to the society. For instance, a person having wealth and giving a part of it to the poor should be considered as performing dravya yajna or wealth sacrifice. If an educated person gives knowledge to an uneducated and ignorant person, it becomes jnana yajna or knowledge sacrifice. Similarly, a yogi using his psychic powers to help those in distress can be considered as accomplishing tapo yajna or austerity sacrifice. If a man performs his duties for the good of the world in the true spirit of a yajna, he should do it in such a way that it helps others in the evolution of their spirit and not undermine it in any way. Hence, he should conduct himself with extreme care. Such persons are called Shrestas, the best ones, by Sri Krishna. They are the true leaders of the society, fit to be emulated by others. Though the Gita has discussed in detail the subject of karma or work as duty, it is primarily a book of the spirit. Hence, great attention has been paid here to moksha or liberation and the path that leads to it. Even in this regard, Sri Krishna's contribution has been original and unique. During the age of the Upanishads, great importance was attached to sarva karma sannyasa, or the abandonment of all actions except those necessary for the maintenance of the body, and jnana yoga, the path of knowledge leading to meditation on the nature of the Atman, the pure incorporeal spirit. As a corollary, work was condemned and relegated to the background. The paths of bhakti, devotion to God, and yoga, concentration of mind, find only a fleeting reference. However, in the Gita, Lord Sri Krishna has not only dealt with all the four spiritual paths or yogas of action, knowledge, devotion, and psychic control in detail, but has also judiciously combined them into one right royal path, with these four as its four aspects closely related to one another. The spiritual aspirants are free to adopt one of them as the main discipline, but integrate the other three also with the same. However, the message of Sri Krishna that instills the greatest hope in the hearts of ordinary spiritual aspirants is that of God's incarnation in the human frame. This is not only possible, but also very real. Whenever dharma declines and adharma runs riot, endangering not only good people, the greatest prop of dharma, but the very existence of an orderly and civilized society, God incarnates himself in a human body called avatara out of his own free will to reverse this trend and to restore the balance. He thereby re-establishes dharma on a firm foundation. If in this process the evil doers have to be punished or even decimated, he does it without hesitation, thereby protecting the good ones. This avatarana, or descent of God into this world in the human form, is not confined to any particular place or time. It is universal, the only condition being the decline of dharma and the advent of jungle law, inflicting great pain and suffering on the good. since the avatara, incarnation of God, is God Himself, one can get whatever one wants by surrendering at His feet. Throughout the Gita, Sri Krishna unhesitatingly declares that He is God Himself, come down to save Dharma, and often exhorts Arjuna to take refuge in Him, promising to deliver him from all sins and liberate him from transmigrating existence. This is the gist of the Gita. We would like to stress one point here. It is not enough to know the essence of the Gita. It is equally necessary to become familiar with the original text. If one can learn its chanting with correct pronunciation, the effect on oneself will be marvelous. In order to help you to learn it, Kumaris Vani Shri and Vijayalakshmi have taken the trouble of chanting the whole Gita correctly in their sweet voice. Listen to it carefully and learn it. Shubhamastu.